And when we think about a place called Egypt, I don't know if you ever heard a sermon on Egypt, but the word Egypt is mentioned. That should be 569 places in the Bible. But a bunch of times it's mentioned in the Bible. And one of the reasons that's mentioned in the Bible, of course, is near Palestine, where you have, that's the promised land where Jesus did his earthly ministry. But Egypt can illustrate a place for spiritual lessons for God's people. And of course, Egypt is used as a symbol in the book of Revelation, chapter 11. When they have finished their testimony, and that is the testimony of the church amid the Roman Empire, the beast that rises from the bottomless pit will make war on them and conquer them and kill them. And that's the Roman emperor, the beast that would persecute the church. And their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city that is symbolically, see, it's a symbol or a figure called Sodom. It's a place of worldliness, which foreshadows the great harlot in the book of Revelation, and Egypt, and also where their Lord was crucified. Jerusalem was a place of religious persecution, and Egypt symbolizes a place of government persecution, because in the Old Testament, you remember Pharaoh and the Egyptian government persecuted the people of God. And so you have the conflict of the church, and Egypt symbolizes opposition. So you see that the word Egypt is used in the Bible as to teach a symbolic lesson about opposition to God. And then the seventh angel blew his trumpet, and there were loud voices in heaven saying, "The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever." So Egypt can be used in the purposes of God. And we see throughout the Bible that Egypt is a place that was used by God. And we can draw, I think, spiritual illustrations or lessons that Egypt may be a place in our life where God allows us to be tested. Egypt symbolically may be a place of refinement of our faith when we're in a difficult situation. And in fact, God can use a place like Egypt as a refuge in this world. The first point, if you look on your outline, Egypt is a place of testing. And I want you to turn to the Old Testament to Genesis chapter 12. Where we remember this is one of the central promises of the Bible, one of the key verses of the Bible. Genesis chapter 12 and verse 2, God speaks to Abraham. Verse 1, go forth from your country. Verse 2, and I'll make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and the ones who curse you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Abraham went forth. So there was a promise, a great nation, a national promise. You had a seed promise, an offspring, and you also had the messianic promise. In you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. And so when Abraham went forth, at this time he was 75 years old, and we can read later that Sarah was 10 years younger than Abraham and would make her 65. Then we read in verse 10, he came to the promised land. So he sojourned several hundred miles, and he comes to the promised land. I want you to notice verse 10. Verse 9, Abraham journeyed on and continued toward the Negev. That's the south part of the promised land. Now there was a famine in the land. So he goes all this way, and he gets to the promised land, and look, some promised land. There is a famine. You know, it's kind of like, on the internet, they'll advertise, I think on eBay, you can buy a 40-acre farm out in Arizona real cheap. I don't know if it's any good or not. It's probably out in the middle of nowhere. If you want to be a hermit, that might be a good thing. But, you know, you can look for these great cheap real estate deals, and you get out there and you say, what a gyp. Now, I want you to think, well, this is a test of Abraham's faith. God told him to go to a lot of trouble. I want you to uproot yourself, your family, and I want you to leave and go to this land that I'm going to show you. He goes and does what God says, and when he gets there, there's a famine. When there's a famine, you stay there, you die. Don't you think that'd be a test of his faith? Verse 10. So Abraham went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. So Abraham, this is around 2100 or so BC, had to take a detour. And he had to go sojourn in Egypt, which Egypt at that time was the great superpower, a great pagan superpower. He would have seen the pyramid there you see on the screen. He would have seen the pyramids of Giza and the Sphinx. And the Sphinx, That was built, I think, around 2200-2300 B.C. The Sphinx was supposed to be, you know, an Egyptian god that would guard the pyramids. And so Egypt was a very sophisticated culture. And Abraham just has himself and his family, and he goes down into this foreign land. And I want you to remember, what promise did God make to him? That he'd make him a great nation. In other words, he would have a lot of offspring. And in verse 11, and it came about when he came near Egypt, he said to Sarah, his wife, "See now, I know that you are a beautiful woman." Now remember, she's 65 years old. She must have been a really beautiful woman. "And it will come about when the Egyptians see you that they will say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill me. But they will let you live. Please say that you are my sister so that it may go well with me because of you, that I may live on your account." And so Sarah was his half-sister. And so it was a half-truth, which is really a whole lie. And he was just trying to deceive Pharaoh because he was afraid they would kill him. Now, if they killed Abraham, what did that mean? That meant that all the promises that God had made to him would not come true. He wouldn't have this offspring. He wouldn't have a great nation. He wouldn't have this great land. And so he goes into a foreign land and he's wondering, can God take care of me here? We might be in a comfortable place and think, oh yes, God can take care of me here. But what on the outer edge, outside of our comfort zone? Do I believe that God can take care of me and that God is like an invisible shield, a refuge, to protect me from what people might do to me? And it was because of his weakness of his faith, he thought God couldn't protect him. But we notice that in spite of Abraham, God's providence protected Abraham in spite of himself. And in verse, we go on and read in verse 15, "As Pharaoh's officials saw her and praised her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house, and therefore he treated Abraham well for her sake, and gave him sheep and oxen and donkeys and male and female servants and female donkeys and camels. But the Lord struck Pharaoh and his house with a great plague because of Sarah, Abraham's wife." God was going to act because he was going to fulfill his greater plan in protecting the offspring of Abraham and Sarah. And Pharaoh called Abraham and said, "What is this that you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister, so I took her for my wife? Then here is your wife, go, take her and go." The idea is that when Abraham's faith faltered, God was able to protect him because God was fulfilling his greater purposes. But what was the good that God brought out of this? In chapter 13, verse 1, "So Abraham went up from Egypt to the Negev," that's the southern part of Palestine, "he and his wife and all that belonged to him and Lot with him." And it says in verse 3, "He went on his journeys from Negev as far as Bethel, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Ai, to the place of the altar which he had made there formerly, where Abraham called on the name of the Lord." He went back to the place where he had worshiped God, where he was close to God, where he had dedicated his faith to God, and he renewed his faith there. And I want you to know that when we go through our Egypt, which it may be a place of testing, a place that maybe we flunk the test. The great thing is God allows do-overs. God allows U-turns. And so he used that as an occasion not to give up, but to renew his faith and to rededicate his faith. And so if we, in our spiritual life is not a straight line up. It's a series of peaks and valleys. And what happens when we fail and when we're weak, we realize we need greater faith and trust in God. God didn't fail. Abraham failed. And God allows us to be tested so we will learn to trust him more. And that's what Abraham learned in rededicating his faith to God. So God allows us to be tested, that God is testing us, that he can take care of us so we do not have to compromise what is right. And it's interesting that Egypt is used as a symbol of compromise. In Isaiah chapter 30 and chapter 31, it says, "Woe to those who go down to Egypt without consulting me." In other words, Judah was tempted to go to Egypt and make a political alliance to compromise because they didn't think God would take care of them. And they trusted in these chariots and these horsemen, and they didn't trust in God. And so today we're going to have tests where we don't know how things are going to turn out. And a faith that has not been tested cannot be trusted. Now turn with me to Hebrews chapter 13. I'm going to read verses 5 through 6. Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have, for he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. So that we confidently say, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What will man do to me? That's what Abraham needed to learn. God would take care of it, despite the challenge of outer circumstances. I need to believe that God can take care of me. I know several examples of Christians who have had to make depending on God to take care of them. For example, we support Brother George Harris down in, Somerville, Alabama, where we support him. Brother George Harris, he was from England. He went to Africa to work as a civil engineer, was converted. Then he decided he wanted to be a gospel preacher. He worked in a church there in Africa. It was in South Africa, which he was supported by a Church of Christ in the United States. The Church of Christ in the United States wanted to have or was part of what's called a sponsoring church arrangement, where they would have oversight of this work over in Africa. And Brother Harris described to me how this elder from the church in the United States came over there, and they were going to take over control of the property, and they were going to have trustees from America to be in control of the church over there where he was. And Brother Harris said that the men of the congregation, that they had a business meeting, and they said, well, we believe the church is independent and autonomous. We don't want you taking over. And they basically said, too bad. And he was fired. He was fired. And he said he had to trust in God that God would take care of him, which he did. When I was in college, there was a brother in the congregation there that he told me one time it was a test. He was working with these other men, and these other men wanted him to lie that they were working when really they weren't, so they wouldn't get in trouble. And he says, I'm not going to lie for you. And so what these other men did is they said, okay, and they didn't, I don't know if they told him or not, but they said, we'll get him back. This is payback time. So on the employee evaluation, they said negative, derogatory things. They lied about him and kept him from getting a raise. And the point is that here is someone that was simply trusting in God to take care of him. And so we have to learn to depend on God without compromising what is right. And that's why God allows us to be tested. Second point is that Egypt can be a place of painful waiting. A place of painful waiting. In our culture, we don't like any pain and we don't like to wait. God allows us not only to be tested, but he allows us to undergo some suffering and discomfort in order to steel our conscience and to refine our character. And the Jews sojourned in Egypt for 430 years. That's from Exodus chapter 12 and verse 40. That's from 1875 B.C. When Joseph was down in Egypt to 1445, which is the estimated time of the Exodus, awaiting entry into the Promised Land. And you remember the story, the reason that the Jews went down into Egypt was because there was a famine in the land, and for them to survive, they had to go down into Egypt. And so what happened is, through the providence of God and using the free will choices of his brothers who made the wrong decision, they sold him into slavery. And then because he was able to interpret dreams, he was framed and he was put in jail. And then because God was with him, he was able to rise and be a overseer in the jail. And then he was able to interpret Pharaoh's dream and then be second in command of Egypt, and then allow for the Jacob and the family to come down into Egypt. But the Bible tells us that when they went down into Egypt, you'll turn over to Exodus. And to me, this is something about dealing with the problem of pain and suffering that I think is instructive to us. There was a new Pharaoh who knew not Joseph, and that's in Exodus chapter 1, verse 7. But the sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty so that the land was filled with them. And this is from the time they went down there. And then a new king or a new Pharaoh rose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Now, a new dynasty, history tells us a new dynasty, Pharaoh Amhos the First arose. It was a different ethnic group, and they wanted to expel foreigners. They expelled a lot of foreigners. So you have this new king that arose, and this is around 1570 B.C., who knew not Joseph. And so they then, verse 10, come let us deal wisely with them, that is the Jews, or else they will multiply in event of war. They will join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and depart from the land. So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor, and they built for Pharaoh storage cities, Phithom and Ramses. So they had to endure slavery and suffering through no fault of their own. And then in Exodus chapter 1 and verse 15, it's estimated this was Pharaoh Thutmose. This is the time that Moses was born. Moses was born approximately 1525 B.C. It says, verse 14, they made their lives bitter with hard labor and mortar and bricks and all kinds of labor in the field, all their labors which they rigorously opposed them. And then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives and told them to kill all the sons that were born to the Jews. But the midwives would not do that, and God blessed them and was with them. And then you have another Pharaoh in Exodus chapter 2 and verse 23. Now it came about in the course of many days that the king of Egypt died, and the sons of Israel sighed. Then another Pharaoh occurs because of the bondage. And they cried out, and their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. And that was thought to be Thutmose the Third. So for many years, they're suffering as slaves through no fault of their own. And we might think that is so unfair. What did we ever do to deserve this? And why is God allowing this to happen to me? So they had to wait in painful slavery. And the reason that they had to wait in painful slavery, and they may have wondered, where is God? They're crying out to God, God, why don't you do something and help us? And God did not intervene. You know why God didn't intervene? Because God was a righteous and a just God. The Bible tells us why He didn't intervene. If you'll turn with me over to Genesis chapter 15, why did God allow His people to go through that suffering for all those years? Because the Bible tells us in Genesis chapter 15 and verse 13, God said to Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions, that is, reparations for slavery. And as for you, shall go to your fathers in peace. In verse 16, then in the fourth generation, that's 400 years or so, they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. The reason God made them stay down in Egypt is to allow the Canaanites to become so utterly corrupt and wicked that when God had Joshua and the children of Israel to utterly destroy them, He was perfectly justified in so doing. That's what Leviticus 18 talks about, that the inhabitants defiled the land through their abomination, which was sexual perversity and human sacrifice. And so when critics of the Bible talk about the atrocities of the Old Testament, that God is somehow a bloodthirsty God, they just simply haven't read all the details of the Bible. God allowed years to transpire so they would become thoroughly corrupt. So when God killed them all, He was perfectly justified in so doing. And so God is a God of justice. And so God allowed them to suffer simply because He had a higher purpose or a higher cause. And I need to realize that God has a greater purpose than my immediate concern or my immediate comfort. As much as we might like God to alter our circumstances in the present, if God does not intervene and alter it, I have to accept the fact that God has a greater purpose than my immediate concern. I have to accept that. But we notice that God didn't intervene immediately, but He would intervene eventually. And we read in Exodus chapter 2 and verse 24, so God heard their groanings, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them. And so when we think God doesn't see, where is God? I don't see God. God sees you. And then later when he appeared to Moses in the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3 and verse 7, after Moses tried to deliver the children of Israel in his own strength, when he was 40 years old in the prime of life, and he murdered an Egyptian by defending a Jew against this Egyptian that was unfairly oppressing him, and then he was afraid he was going to be found out, and he fled Egypt for the land of Midian. Then he was a shepherd for 40 years. God appeared to this shepherd who was getting schooled in how to live in the wilderness. And, you know, that's going to come in handy for 40 years in the wilderness. Moses spent 40 years scoping out the land, the wilderness, where the Jews were going to later end up. The Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and I've given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, for I'm aware of their suffering. So I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians and to bring them up from the land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Amorite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite. Now behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them. Therefore, come now, and I will send you to Pharaoh. I have to remember, God is never late. God is never late. God did not forget his promise. The Pharaoh there to the right is Amenhotep II, who is supposed to be the Pharaoh of the Exodus, the most powerful man in the world at that time. Egypt was the superpower. To the right, as you see, I have two mummies up there. That's their mummies, not their mommies. It's their mummies. The one of Amhos I, and then the mummy to the bottom right is the eldest son of Amenhotep II. He is 10 years old. It's Prince Winnesu. And you remember the 10 plagues, which was a judgment on the gods of the Egyptians, that God was stronger than the gods of the Egyptians? God intervened in history. Even though they had to painfully wait, God says, I'll make it up to you. You'll come out with many possessions. Where do you think they got all the gold and all the stuff to build the tabernacle in the wilderness? It's from the Egyptians. He said, you'll plunder the Egyptians. And that's where they learned they had to depend on God. And so we see the faithful sometimes suffer due to the wrong choices of free will men. Yet God has greater purposes than our immediate comfort, and God can bring good out of evil. And that's what Romans 8:28 says. We know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God and to those who are called according to his purpose. So I need to believe that whatever situation that I'm in, if it's painful or if it's difficult, I need to remember that God is greater than any circumstance and God can bring good out of that. And remember when Joseph was down in Egypt and he was unfairly accused by Mrs. Potiphar or Potiphar's wife and had to go to jail, and his brothers, you know, sold him into slavery. Joseph, looking back on that, his time in Egypt, said in Genesis chapter 50 and verse 20 about the providence of God, you meant it against me for evil, but God meant it for good, that he might bring many people alive. And we need to remember what may be hard to bear can be sweet to remember when we look back and we see how God is refining our faith and helping us to learn to wean us away from all false hopes and self-sufficiency so we will learn to trust in God alone. That's what Psalm 105 said, that God made Israel in Egypt stronger than the Egyptians. God made them stronger in going through that painful waiting process. And so we must persevere by faith through our Egyptian difficulty or painful situation. I'm reading from 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 5 through 7. 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 5 through 7. Peter says, you are protected by the power of God through faith for salvation ready to be revealed at the last time. In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials, so that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. He says you're being distressed by these trials. And the Christians were being, and Peter's talking about their fiery ordeal, and this may refer to emperor worship, and if the Christians didn't worship the emperor, they were persecuted for that. But he says that God's faith, I mean, if your faith in God produces a power that can protect you. And so the world can hurt us on the outside, but they can't hurt us on the inside. If our faith on the inside is directed in relying fully on God. And so it says, when you go through this process where you feel like maybe not being like a Christian, or you feel like, what use is it? Or why is God making me go through this? I need to remember the end result, that God is refining or purging all these impurities to build about a stronger character. I read where someone who is a silver smelter smelt silver, and you have to heat it up to burn off the dross and the impurities. And someone said, how do you know when it's been refined enough? And the smelter said, when I can look at it and see my reflection in it. And so when we go through these trials and suffering, what that should do is not make us bitter, but make us better. It should drive us closer to God, where we take on the character of God in Jesus Christ. Third point, which is kind of an interesting twist, Egypt had been the arch enemy of God's people in the Old Testament, but yet, God could use Egypt as a place of refuge. Remember the story about baby Jesus, that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, and that the wise men from the east had come to worship him, and they went to the wrong fellow to find out where the king of the Jews was born, because Herod was a kind of a crazed, jealous dictator. And Matthew chapter 2 and verse 2, they asked, where is he who's been born king of the Jews? And they said that it's going to be in Bethlehem of Judea, which was a fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. And so what happened is that King Herod was a jealous monarch who would book no rivals. And in verse 13, Herod said that tell me where he's born so I can go worship him, which was a lie. Verse 13, now when they had gone, that is the wise men, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, get up, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt. Now in the original, get up is exclamation point. That's a sense of urgency. You need to get up right now and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to destroy him. So Joseph got up and took the child and his mother while it was still night and left for Egypt. And he remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet. Out of Egypt did I call my son. That's a fulfillment from Hosea, and it's a type antitype where you have God calling his son, the children of Israel, out of Egypt, and they were a disobedient son. Jesus as a type of God's son, or the obedient nation, would come out of Egypt to be obedient to God, to fulfill what was lacking of God's people in the Old Testament. In verse 16, when Herod saw that he had been tricked by the Magi, he became very enraged and sent and slew all the male children who were in Bethlehem and all its vicinity from 2 years old and under, according to the time which had been determined from the Magi. And we might think, oh, that Herod is such a murderous, awful jerk, would go in and want to kill all these little babies. Imagine his soldiers coming in and tearing the babies out of the arms of their mother and to kill those little baby boys. Well, Herod certainly chose to do it, but the book of Revelation, in Revelation chapter 12, gives this very graphic picture in the unseen spiritual realm. It was not just Herod that wanted to kill Jesus, but it was the devil, who was this awful red dragon that wanted to destroy the Messiah after he was born. I'm reading, if you'll turn over to Revelation chapter 12, which gives the background. Why is there a conflict between the Roman Empire and the church? Well, because Satan is behind it. And Satan has been opposing the Messiah for his entire career on earth. In Revelation chapter 12, and a great sign appeared in heaven, and a woman clothed with the sun, and the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. This is a symbol for the descendants or the faithful remnant. And she was with child, and she cried out, giving, being in labor and in pain, and gave birth. And then another sign appeared in heaven. And behold, a great red dragon having several heads and 10 horns. And on his head were 7 diadems. And his tail swept away a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she gave birth, he might devour her child. And she gave birth to a son, a male child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. You know, the book of Revelation is a controversial book, but there is not one commentator that doesn't say Revelation 12:4 refers to Jesus Christ. Every one of them says that that was Jesus Christ who was to rule the nations with a rod of iron. Okay, we know that's Jesus Christ. So who was standing over the woman and wanted to devour? Was it Herod? The Bible says it was Satan, a great red dragon in the unseen spiritual world that wanted to destroy Christ. Which Genesis 3:15 said that the serpent or the descendant of the serpent or Satan, the prototype of the serpent, that which would be Satan or evil, would bruise the heel of the Messiah. And that was Satan. Satan was behind the plot to kill the Messiah. And so Jesus' Egypt was a refuge from danger and fulfillment of prophecy. We continue in Revelation 12, verses 5 and 6. So her child was caught up to God and to his throne. Now that can either mean he was protected by God, or the idea that's the ascension of Christ. Then the woman fled into the wilderness where she had a place prepared by God so that she would be nourished for 1,260 days. That's 3.5 years. That's a symbol of a partial time. That's a broken seven. And so if you read this, and I won't go, I know Revelation's a difficult book, but it talks about how the woman was protected from the great dragon. The great dragon would cause a flood to try to destroy the woman. And the earth would open and swallow up this flood. And it's just a wonderful picture of how when Satan's onslaught of evil, all the forces of hell would come out and try to destroy the Christ. God's providence would intervene to ensure that his messianic plan of salvation would succeed. And Jesus was protected in Egypt until his enemy Herod was dead. God provided a refuge for Jesus. And the great thing is the Bible says that God can provide us a refuge. God can provide us a refuge. I'm reading in Psalm chapter 18. Psalm chapter 18. I encourage you to read the book of Psalms if you feel far away from God, to build your faith that God can protect you, provide a refuge wherever you are in whatever situation you're dealing with. The Bible tells us in Psalm chapter 18, verse 2, the Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation and my stronghold. I've got a picture in my office that has this verse underneath. It's a fellow who is looking outside of the base of a lighthouse, where on the other side you have this huge wave crashing against the base of the lighthouse. It's a real neat picture. I'll show it to you sometime, and I'll use that in a lesson, but I like that picture. But here he says that God is my rock, my fortress, my deliverer, in whom I take refuge. He's my shield. He's my horn of salvation, my stronghold. Verse 3, I call upon the Lord who is worthy to be praised, and I am saved from my enemies. The cords of death encompassed me, and the torrents of the ungodliness terrified me. The cords of Sheol surrounded me. That is, he almost died. The snares of death confronted me. And in my distress, I called upon the Lord and cried to my God for help. And he heard my voice out of his temple. Brother Forrest Short, who preached in Zimbabwe for 40 years, talked about, as a man who's preaching now, he's supporting himself by gardening and selling produce on the side of the road. But he talked about this preacher, and I can't pronounce his name because of the language difference, but his name means elephant, but that's what I remember. But this young boy, when he was a teenager, was during the time of the 1970s where you had the communist uprising in Zimbabwe, where they were persecuting Christians. They were trying to get the natives to join the communist revolution to overthrow the government. And there was this young teenage boy, for whatever reason, decided that he was going to join the communists, and so the rebels. And so, because his friends did that, and so he went to one of these camps where they would teach them how to use an AK-47, how to bayonet people, and, you know, basically be a communist rebel. When he got there in this camp, his conscience began to bother him. When they handed him an AK-47 and was going to teach him how to shoot and to bayonet people, he said he couldn't do it. He told him, "I can't do it." And he said, I expected them to bayonet me on the spot. But for some reason, they let me go. And he says, "I believe that God was protecting me." And so he had to travel several hundred miles on foot through the wilds of Zimbabwe to get back home. But he believed that God was his refuge, God was his strength, this invisible support, that God was there. He wasn't going to do what was wrong. He was going to do what is right, and that God would take care of it. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13 says, "God is faithful, and he will not allow you to be tempted above that which you're able, but with the temptation provide a way of escape, a place of refuge to get away from this bad situation." So we're thankful that God is real and God provides what we need. So in conclusion, this fallen world is the best of all possible worlds, for the purpose has in allowing it to exist as a place of soul shaping and to refine our loving reliance on God, that God causes all things to work together for good to those who are called according to His purpose. We need to be thankful that we believe in a God who's in control.